It really is a pleasure to get to be with you. And Chase, thank you for picking out those wonderful songs. Really, really nice songs tonight for being able to study the lesson. So I've come up here tonight with a Bible, a microphone, and no notes because I've just changed the sermon a lot from the way I had the notes originally. And I just want to speak to you from the heart tonight. Where have we been this week? We started on Sunday and we talked about the kind of zeal that Titus had and the kind of encouragement that was to other Christians, particularly Paul, when he was feeling really down. And we looked at the life of Paul and how it wasn't enough just to be zealous to like pick on other people, but he needed to have a Christ-like zeal. We've tried to talk about how to fuel that zeal with wisdom and diligence and energy and loving service and all of these qualities, most especially courage from 1st and 2nd Peter. We said, but sometimes we're going to get burnt out. We're just going to be exhausted and beat up, and we need to not throw in the towel, but to turn back around and see how we can continue to serve the Lord. So tonight we're pulling it all together. How do we use our zeal? What are we supposed to be doing with this quality? Titus chapter 2, verse 14 said that those people that he has redeemed, those people that he has purified, those people he's taken possession of, are supposed to be zealous for good deeds. So if you would take your Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 1, we're going to look at a guy that I think is extremely zealous for good deeds and start to consider how he was able to change his corner of the world. We remember in the book of Acts that the apostles were described as those that had turned the world upside down. And yeah, there are days that we wish we had that level of influence to just really dramatically change the whole nation, the whole world. And we may not have an influence that extensive, but we do have an influence. We can change our corner of the world. And in the book of Nehemiah, we are reading about a guy that has so much passion for God, so much zeal for doing good works, that he leaves the cushiest job possible, right? He is the cupbearer to the king. Let me challenge you to go look on Wikipedia at a Persian cup from the time period of Nehemiah. I mean, they're like giant horn-shaped gold. He had a great job. And he left that job, traveled about 800 miles back to a broken and neglected city because he was zealous for good works. We need to learn a couple of things from Nehemiah. First, if you'll look here in Nehemiah chapter 1 in verse 4, you can see that he was determined to make a difference in an area where his heart had been touched. Chapter 1 and verse 4, when he heard about the state of Jerusalem, when I heard these words, I sat down and I wept and mourned for days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Nehemiah was heartbroken to hear the condition of the city. Now I need to tell you about Sam. Sam is one of our newest elders down at Embry Hills. And it was decided that I was going to teach the zeal material in an adult Bible class. And he walked in and he said, listen, Philip, I just got to tell you. We always try to send an elder to different classes, and I did not want to be in this class. I thought, well, wow, what an encouraging thing to hear, Sam. He said, I did not want to be in this class, but I decided that the very fact I didn't want to means I probably needed to be in here. And by the end of the class, you know what Sam figured out? His heart was broken. His heart was broken watching young married couples struggle through the same battles he and his wife had to struggle through with nobody to help. And so Sam took it upon himself as a shepherd, as a local elder. He's like, I'm going to have all these young couples to my house. And he put together 6 lessons, and he'd have 4 couples come over and go through all 6 lessons with them over a series of weeks. Then he'd have 4 more couples come, and 4 more couples come, and 4 more couples come, because he was brokenhearted to think of young couples trying to do this all on their own. And he didn't want to see more divorces or more broken hearts and broken families. So he just decided, this is where I can use my zeal. That's what's happening for Nehemiah. I want to tell you, when you start trying to figure out where to use your zeal, what do you lose sleep over? Is it domestic violence? Is it orphans? Is it those that have their souls lost because of false doctrine? What do you lose sleep over? Because that's probably one of the places you need to start bringing God's wisdom and God's love into. If you look at chapter 2 and verse 1, it came about in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, though you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart." Then I was very much afraid. Do you know where we found sadness of heart at my house? My wife was seeing all of these news stories about, again, Ukraine, about this was 10 years ago or more. Wow, this was 12 years ago. But about orphans in Ukraine. And she said, "Philip, we have to do something about this." I said, "Okay, I can tell you are losing sleep. This is really important to you. We can like send $200. And she's like, "No, we have to do something about this." And she called me one day. She said, "I'm at the Hilton and I'm about to rent their ballroom on our personal credit card because we're having a fundraiser for orphans." I was like, "Okay, go for it. I will support you in this." And she just started, you're doing all this stuff. Like, where are you brokenhearted? Where's that sadness? The king could see it in Nehemiah. Verse 3, "I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire?' So the king said to me, 'What would you request?' So I prayed to the God of heaven." Have you done that? Pray about that thing that is breaking your heart. "And I said to the king, 'If it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, then send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it.'" And this dialogue begins, and they start asking him all these different questions. And he says, "Well, it's going to take these timbers, and I'm going to have to travel this distance. I'm going to need a little bit of money." He goes, "Fine, I'll take care of all of that. But you go, and you do this." So we need to think about where we can make a difference. And it's probably that thing that keeps you up at night. But it's not enough just to have that feeling deep in your heart. You see here in chapter 2, Nehemiah had to learn to talk about that. He had to mention it to the king that could provide those resources. If you look at the end of chapter 2, in verse 17 and verse 18, it becomes really, really important that he can identify this problem, that he can speak with crystal clear clarity. This is where the problem is. Verse 17, "Then I said to them, 'You see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates are burned by fire.'" And you have to imagine somebody in the back of the crowd was like, "Thanks, Captain Obvious. Like, we've been living in this city for decades. We know the gates have been burned by fire." But he states it for this purpose. It was more than broken walls. Read it with me again. Verse 17, "Its gates are burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach." What does it mean to be a reproach? How is the city a reproach? Well, all the people in the surrounding lands go, "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They worship that Jehovah God, but he must not be very powerful. Because look at his people, how poor they are. They worship that Jehovah God. He must not be a very impressive God. They're awfully lukewarm. They're just sitting there in a broken city." They're being made fun of. They're being mocked. And it's not just the people being mocked, but it reflects poorly on God. And we have to be able to say, you know what the real problem is? It's that our behavior and the status quo reflects poorly on God. And he just deserves better than that. And we're not going to sit around and let other people mock the God, creator of heaven, because we aren't doing our part. And so he speaks with clarity about this problem, but not just the problem, also the solution. Let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. Remember in this story, they get it done in like 52 days. They were able to do the work, but they had to come together. And then the good news, verse 18, "I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. So then they said, 'Let us arise and build.'" Something awesome happens between the problem and the solution and them arising to work, right? He steps in and goes, by the way, guys, the king is going to pay for the whole thing. I'm not here to raise your taxes. I'm not here to push you into slavery. The king has already given us everything we need. Our king has given us everything we need. We are adequately and thoroughly equipped for every good work through the scriptures. We are a body. We love each other. We care about each other. We are not going to give up on each other. Our king is the reason we can get to work. I love what Nehemiah is doing here. Come over to chapter 4. Of course, you know that there's always going to be the critics. There's always going to be those that mock those that are trying to do the Lord's work. And so we see that he has to adjust his plans a little bit. In chapter 4, verse 14, you have like the halftime speech at the Super Bowl. You know how the coach has to come in at halftime and get everybody rallied back up. Okay, guys, we're down a little bit, but we're not done yet. Verse 14, I saw their fear. So I rose and I spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and who is awesome. Fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Doesn't that sound like, you know, a halftime speech? Come on, guys. Remember what we can do here. Remember what's on the line. Verse 15. When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plans, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. They have to adapt. He has to rally them back around. And then you read in verse 16 on through the rest of the chapter about how they would have a brick in one hand and a sword in the other hand, right? And how they would just go back and forth. And I tell you, that would be exhausting if you thought you had to do that forever. You need to remember this week that although we are studying zeal, I am not asking you to crank it up to 11 and hold it there for the next 75 years. I'm saying find the season that ask a little bit more of you. And for 50 days, give it your all. Because what they do in this one season creates momentum to change everything else. Listen, when Tracy and I lived in Florida, we did not have enough money for like a nice gas grill for our hamburgers. We had enough money for an itty bitty grill, all right? And we put our charcoal in there, and I learned something. Charcoal grilling is easy if you have enough lighter fluid. We just would douse that thing with lighter fluid. And as soon as you drop the match on, you know what happens. Whoosh, up go the flames. But the only way you actually cook hamburgers is after the accelerant has gone off, the coals are changed. If they get hotter, then you can use it. Then you can cook your burgers. I'll drive back to Atlanta tomorrow. It doesn't matter if I'm an accelerant temporarily. What matters is what's going to change in our hearts because God wants us to be zealous for good deeds. Nehemiah is here with the people, changing their hearts, adapting to difficult circumstances, making things clear so that they can both be encouraged and finish. And they really finish very, very well. In chapter 6, we see one of the other obstacles to being able to finish, and this has just become a life-saving verse for me. Nehemiah chapter 6 and verse 3. When the enemies are out there full of distractions and rumors and interruptions, he replies with tremendous wisdom. I sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? Moms, you're doing a great work. You can't come down. You've got important things to do for your children. Elders, deacons, you're doing a great work. You can't come down. Why should the work stop? We are supposed to stay focused on the work of the Lord and not let rumors or distractions or interruptions pull us away from what we know pleases God. Nehemiah is able to rebuild the city, but more importantly, rebuild the people. And he changes his corner of the world. That's the way we're supposed to use our zeal. Okay. So you have that picture. That's the overarching message of the lesson tonight. Let's take that more personal.
What does that look like first in our families and second in the local congregation? First with our families. If you want to spread your zeal, if you want to take what you're learning and what you're studying and pull someone else along and pull people together to really be a team, then you need to think about Noah, right? Noah in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 7, we have this tiny synopsis of his incredible life, and we see what was driving him. Chapter 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness, which is according to faith. In reverence, he was getting ready for a day that destruction was coming. And it wasn't just getting ready for himself, but he was getting ready for those that were the closest to him. We have got to follow in those footsteps of Noah. It's not about just building an impressive resume. It's not about just building a comfortable retirement. We are trying to build a spiritual ark for those around us. Noah knew what was on the line here, and he used his faith in God to prepare for battles that were not yet seen. We can't wait until the rain is already falling. We have to think about what we're doing to lead by faith early. Secondly, be like Jonathan. Come back to 1 Samuel chapter 19. It's so tempting in 1 Samuel just to focus on David. But do you realize where David would be without the friendship of Jonathan? It seems to me that Jonathan, time after time after time, comes and provides non-tangible help to David. Look at chapter 19 and verse 4. Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father. He said, "Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand, and he struck the Philistines, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause?" Jonathan has access to an awful lot of weapons. Jonathan has access to an awful lot of money and food. But some of the most valuable help Jonathan ever gave David was the intangibles. Don't underappreciate what you can do for others through your presence, through your kindness, through your thoughtfulness, just through being an advocate that speaks up on the behalf of others. That's all Jonathan is doing at this point, is just talking to Saul and saying, no, don't be his enemy. Look at chapter 20 and verse 3. David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight." He said, "Do not let Jonathan know this, or he'll be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives, as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death." And then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." He kind of goes on this reconnaissance mission, right? So we come to the end of the chapter in verse 41. After the lad was gone, David rose from the south side, fell on his face to the ground, bowed three times, and they kissed each other and wept together, and David wept the more. You know what I used to think? I thought it was my job as the preacher to roll into the hospital sometime and sit with that person that their spouse was having surgery and tell some lighthearted joke and just have a little banter and distract them from the very, very serious surgery. Because I was really confused about rejoicing with those who rejoice and weeping with those who weep. I was trying to rejoice with those who were weeping. And I'm thankful that I've at least finally figured out that sometimes it's my job not to distract people, but to be sad with them and concerned with them and to sit there and say, yeah, I care about that person too. It is important for us to make those heart connections the way Jonathan does here, just that others know we genuinely have an invested emotional interest in their well-being. Jonathan provides some pretty impressive, intangible help.
Look at 23 verse 17. 23 verse 17. Thus he said to him, "Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul my father will not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you, and Saul my father knows that also."
Jonathan is coming to David and saying, "Listen, I know you're stressed out. I know you're afraid, but don't be afraid, because I see your future more clearly than you can see it yourself." And one of the kindest compliments you can give to a young adult is to come and say, "Listen, y'all are on the right track, and you keep it up, and you're not even going to believe how nice the story of your life turns out. There's going to be some highs and there's going to be some lows, but I can see the path that you're on and where that goes." And as long as we are putting our heart in the Word of God and our faith in God Himself, we know that path has a great ending.
It is that intangible refocusing that Jonathan is so good at. And thirdly, like the Philippians, we need to rally around the progress of the gospel. Now, you might think that I am a sports fan because I keep talking about the Super Bowl and football games and stuff, but actually that's just all the sports I know, and I have to keep coming back to that. But I'm going to do it one more time. I need you to think about going to a football game.
I need you to think about going to this football game with your very best friends. And you have whatever your preferred seats are. If you want to be right behind the team on the, you know, front row at the 50-yard line, imagine that. If you want to be in the super awesome box seats where they bring you the little shrimp, you imagine that. But I want you to think about being there with your very best friends, rooting on your favorite team as they play, you know, across the field, whatever. Okay. That is not fellowship. Sometimes we think that having that recreational social time around a shared activity, that that's like quote-unquote fellowship. Now think about the guys actually on the field holding the football, and all of them are committed to making it 50 more yards to get that touchdown. And me and you are completely devoted to moving this ball forward, to making forward progress. Read Philippians chapter 1 with me. Look at Philippians chapter 1, verse 12. He says to the Philippians in this like amazing, love, encouraging, friendly thank you letter, "I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel." The Philippians are not in the stands sitting back going, "Oh, look what the apostles are doing. That's so entertaining." The Philippians are actively engaged in helping Paul make progress in the gospel. "I want you to know, brethren, how my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel." Skip down to verse 21. "For to me, to live is Christ and to die is gain. But if I am to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which to choose. I'm hard pressed from both directions, having the desire to depart and be with Christ, for that is very much better. Yet to remain on in the flesh is more necessary for your sake. And convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith." This whole letter is a picture of actual fellowship where we are actively engaged in spiritual progress. There are no spectators in the church, right? We're all on the field. We're all out there doing the work, and each of us have different roles to play, but all of those roles contribute towards the progress of the gospel. If we set our mind towards that kind of teamwork, fellowship, our zeal gets used in wonderful ways. So let me zero in really specifically on the local church from one key text. Please look at Acts 21. Acts 21, this will be the last chapter we look at this evening. The story of Acts 21 is after the third missionary journey. When we come to Acts chapter 21, it's approximately 25 years after the first sermon Peter preaches in Acts chapter 2. And we read about the church in Jerusalem in Acts 2, and there are thousands and thousands of people. But 25 years later, things are different. It's not just a Jewish church anymore. Gentiles have been receiving the gospel, been added to the church, been saved in the blood of Christ. And not only have Gentiles been added, but when you come to Acts 21, where are the apostles? The apostles were there in Acts 2. The apostles were there through most of the beginning of Acts, but they're gone. It's just the elders, teachers, and members. It's very much like the church today. They're still depending on the teaching of the apostles, but the apostles themselves are not there. And in Acts 21, the church is working together. It's tempting just to study this chapter and say, oh yeah, yeah, I know this chapter. Paul gets arrested. Skip the stuff about Paul. Look at what the church is doing in Acts 21. This is a cool church. Verse 15. After these days, we got ready. We started on our way to Jerusalem. And some of the disciples from Caesarea also came with us, taking us to Mason of Cyprus, a disciple of long standing with whom we were to lodge. And after we arrived in Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. The following day, Paul went in with us to James, and to all the elders were present. After he had greeted them, he began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they began glorifying God. Do you see how Paul's not putting the spotlight on himself? The spotlight, God has been doing this, and God gets the glory. Verse 20, they said, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews and those who have believed. They're all very zealous for the law. They've been told about you that you're teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the customs. What then is to be done? They'll certainly hear that you have come. And the elders have a plan for this. Walk through this church for a minute. What did you see in verse 16 and in verse 18? Did you notice Mason? Mason in verse 16. He's called Mason of Cyprus, a disciple of long standing with whom we were to lodge. He's somebody people can count on. He's not from that area. He's not from Jerusalem, is he? He's Mason of Cyprus. He's from like that cool little island. We have a few members back in Atlanta that are from the Caribbean, and it's always fun to talk to them and hear the story of their lives and everywhere their work and their studies have taken them. And just, I love the island accent. You know, like the whole thing is fun. Mason of Cyprus is there. But he's a disciple of long standing. He's got this reputation that when Paul needs a place to go, he'll open his home. It seems to me even the brethren of Caesarea are traveling with Paul to some extent, so he'll just make room for them as well. He's the one you can count on. He puts down some roots and he makes a difference. And it's not just Mason that has that kind of heart here. Did you read who was there in verse 18?
The following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all of the elders were present.
That means James has been in Jerusalem for like maybe all 25 years. James was there in Acts chapter 2. James shows up in the other early chapters of Acts. James is in Acts 15 when they had the decision about the Gentiles. And James is still there. It doesn't say that he's an elder. Doesn't say that he's a preacher. It doesn't really give us a role. But you know what we know about James from his epistle? He is saturated with the words of Christ, right? You read through the book of James, and just time and time again, all these little problems and the wisdom that he's given, it's kind of like echoes of the Sermon on the Mount. Because James is the one that can take the Sermon on the Mount and go, hey, that's how you do this. He can take the Sermon on the Mount, the words of Jesus, and say, and that's what we need here in the church. James is just this member who knows Jesus so well, he always has something useful to contribute. That's the kind of members we are supposed to be. There is not a church in existence that would not be thankful to have a member who is saturated with the Sermon on the Mount, saturated with the teachings of Jesus. If you're that kind of person, people can count on you. You will be a blessing in the local church. I want to be that kind of person. Secondly, I want to be the kind of person that builds trust with both openness and cooperation. I think I told you guys that so many things at Embry Hills just run on trust. We have a lot of trust between the elders, a lot of trust between the evangelists, a lot of trust between the teachers. We can't do it without trust. And lots of people say, oh yeah, I would love to go to church like that. But you know how you get it? Look what Paul did. Verse 18. The following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all of the elders were present. And after he greeted them, he began to relate to them one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles. Wait a minute. The big problem they're about to lay out for him in verse 20, 21, 22, 23, 24 is that you've been working with the Gentiles and everybody's going to hear about it. And you're going to like cause a riot because of all this stuff with the Gentiles. Don't you know it would have been so easy for Paul to be like, oh, I go to the synagogues a lot too. We don't have to talk about that Gentile stuff. Nobody wants to hear about that. That's just going to create problems. And I'm going to just kind of keep that whole Gentile thing to myself. Or maybe he would have said like, well, you know, I can talk about that Gentile thing to just this average church member over here. But when I'm with James and the elders, and what did verse 21 say? I think it was 21, that they're connected to thousands of Jews who are zealous for the law. When I'm with them, I'm going to emphasize my work with the Jews. And when I'm over here, I'm going to emphasize my work with the Gentiles. No, no. Even among the leadership, even among those that might have been the most critical of what he had done, he lays it out with openness. This is what I teach. This is where I go. And this is what I believe. He is open with them. We need that to build trust. If we're always guarding what's going on in some other part of our life, if we're always calculating who can I say this to, who can I say that to, that doesn't build trust. Let's be open with each other the way Paul was. Now, Paul also, you know, most places he went, this is his third missionary journey that's wrapping up, he kind of calls the shots, doesn't he? I mean, like you go into a city and whatever Paul says, that's what we're all going to do. And Paul can say, Titus, you stay here and Timothy, you go there. And everybody pretty much does it. So read with me beginning in verse 23. Therefore, do this that we tell you. Hey, Paul, you're not calling the shots. We tell you do this. We have here four men who are under a vow. Take them and purify yourself along with them. Pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. And all will know that there is nothing to the things which they have been told about you. Hey, Paul, we need your actions to speak louder than your words. Paul, we've got thousands of people in the church here, and we could call a big special assembly, and we could try to explain to everybody the differences between Jews and Gentiles, but we're just not going to do that. We're just asking you to do this one thing. And we know our members. We know the sheep in our flock. They are attentive. They are they're connected. And when you do this, problem solved. So he says, go do this, shave their heads. Verse 24, but that you yourself walk orderly, keeping the law. Concerning the Gentiles who have believed, we already wrote, having decided they should abstain from meat, sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what is strangled, and from fornication. Then Paul took them in the next day, purifying himself along with them. When was the last time that you were asked to cooperate in something and it wasn't your big idea? There's a time and place for your big ideas, but somebody just said, no, you need to just trust us. You've been very open, but now we need your cooperation. I need you to do this. And I know you spent all your time with the Gentiles out there, but we've got these four guys that are like super serious about the law. And I need you to go spend some time with those four guys. And there was no hesitation. The next day, he purifies himself. Keep reading in the chapter. How long does it take? 7 days. In the 7 days that Paul spends with the church at Jerusalem, a significant portion of his time and energy is with these four men that are extremely devoted to the law. That might not have been his first choice. But the elders had the wisdom. Will you cooperate over here. And what's the payoff? Verse 27.
When the 7 days were almost over, Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him. They were crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law and this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." The payoff is the church doesn't split. The church doesn't attack Paul. The only trouble in this chapter comes from the Jews from Asia, from verse 27.
What the elders proposed worked. It preserved the unity of the local congregation. Trouble only starts when people are listening to the Jews from Asia. And you see in verse 28 and verse 29 that they're making ridiculous accusations based on nothing but assumption.
Verse 29, they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. We can't control the kind of assumptions that the rest of the world makes. But we can control whether or not we interact with one another with a sense of openness and cooperation. And the more we do, the more we build trust that allows some great things to happen.
So final point here in verse 21 is that when he did this, you can see he is spending time with a lot of different people. We saw in verse 16 he was with Mason. We saw in verse 18, he's with leaders like James and the elders.
We saw in verse 23 and 24, he's with some of the most Jewish-minded members. And now we see in verse 29 that he was spending time with Trophimus the Ephesian, who is clearly a Gentile, or else they wouldn't accuse him of taking Gentiles to the temple.
I want you to think about who you're building friendships with. Don't just build friendships with people that are the exact same age, with the exact same life circumstances, or blue collar, or white collar, or whatever. It is our common faith that makes our friendships meaningful. And that common faith creates relationships that is much, much deeper than just a common background. In the 7 days we're reading about him, Paul, at the church at Jerusalem, he's with everybody. And that needs to be our heart and mind, to build those brotherly and sisterly relationships across the family of God. It will allow us to use our zeal in wonderful ways, so you won't just be kept up at night, but you'll be getting up each morning saying, "I know that together we can make a difference." I thank you so much for all the encouragement you have been to me, and I hope that the lessons are making a difference for you. If there's someone here tonight that needs to render obedience to the gospel, needs to come and confess their faith in Christ, then everything is ready for you to respond with faith and to be baptized. But if there's just somebody here that your zeal, you're like, "Yeah, we had that lighter fluid, it shot up, but it's just crumbling." We're here to help. You don't have to fizzle out alone. We want to stir you up and build you up. Let us pray for you by coming forward as we stand and sing.